and I would like to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. Mary Neal.
So I am really good at giving monologues when it comes to medical issues. When it comes to this, I'd prefer it to be more of a dialogue because I really don't feel like this is a lecture. I really feel like it's a dialogue. Although I know that for those of you who've been to the meeting before, it's typically first part is a presentation and then there are questions, but we'll see how it goes. Feel free to interrupt me if you have a burning question. If you do have a question, it's probably a question that many other people are thinking as well. So feel free to interrupt me and we'll sort of see. I'm very good at rambling on for a long period of time because it's a topic that's really of interest to me. I am an orthopedic surgeon. I will give you a little bit of my background, and then we'll kind of move forward and I'll move somewhat quickly and you can slow me down if you want. But I grew up in Michigan and I feel like my childhood was very ordinary. I think it's pretty typical of most people that grew up in the 50s and 60s. I went to church on Sunday mornings and that was a Sunday thing. That was in the days when people went to church and then went out on the steps and lit up their cigarettes and started swearing at everyone and yelling, and clearly a Sunday thing. And I was never asked to think about spirituality per se, or certainly not to incorporate it into my daily life or thinking. In high school, I did have some spiritual experiences. I was in a car accident and felt like God had protected me. And at that point in time, I did sort of rededicate my life or say, okay, well, I'm going to be a spiritually committed person. Then I went to college, and in your 20s, it's very easy when you're busy to forget about that part of life. Again, I would say that I was pretty typical. I went to college, I went to medical school, and did my residency training. And during that time, every so often, it would bubble to the surface and I would think, oh, okay, I'm really gonna actually think about my spiritual life now. And then life got in the way. Then I had children. Like many people, it's really when you have children that you begin that transition of thinking about life. What does it all mean? And really thinking about your spiritual life. And of course, I said, okay, well, I'm gonna be better than my parents were. And I'm going to not only take my kids to Sunday school, but I'm going to actually incorporate that into our daily lives. And I will not claim that I was good at doing that. I was very busy. I have full-time practice, husband. I had four kids pretty close together. So life was very busy. And then finally, when my youngest son was a toddler, it was a little over a year, I thought that I would take my husband to Chile and go kayaking. And before any of you stop listening right there and think, well, of course she died. She went kayaking. My husband and I kayak quite a bit. Our kids kayak. We are avid boaters, and I wouldn't want to be quoted to any of my friends when I say this, but I mean, I'm a really good paddler, so it's not something that is out of my skill set. And my kids were old enough at that time to stay home. We were fortunate enough to have a full-time babysitter, so she stayed with the kids. We went to Chile with friends of ours who are professional boaters. They own a raft and kayak store, and this is what they do. They run trips to Chile in the winter. We spent a week paddling all the rivers and having a great time. And what would have been our final day of paddling, my husband woke up with horrible back pain, which he's never had before that or since. But that particular morning, he had terrible back pain, so he actually didn't go on the river with us. He dropped us off and then found a nice sunny spot, decided to read, and he was going to pick us up at the end of the day. We started down the river, and this river is in a very remote part of South America, and the river itself is entirely inaccessible, which is why my husband didn't paddle. Once you're on the river, you're committed. The hillsides were very steep and very thickly forested with bamboo. So we started down, and I have to say I didn't particularly feel comfortable when we started. There were a couple of people who I didn't particularly feel had the skills to be on that section of the river. This section of the river had a lot of volume, and it was well known for its waterfalls or its drops. They weren't waterfalls like Niagara Falls. These are waterfalls that are in the range of 10 to 15 feet, maybe a little bit more, entirely reasonable and workable. We went over a couple of drops, and then we came to one, and the person who went before me went over what we had identified was not necessarily the main drop, but the drop we were going to take. She ended up sideways in the drop, and this was a drop between rocks. The boat was stuck, and she got out of the boat and swam. Her boat basically blocked this channel. If any of you, how many people boat? Anyone? Okay, well, not a lot of people, but the current is moving, and there are no eddies or slow parts of the water. You're committed, and I was committed. The one channel blocked, I deviated off and took the only other channel that was available. As soon as I crested over the drop, I could see that there was no clean exit, meaning there wasn't a lot of water, nice channel leaving the drop. And I knew that this was not going to be good. But my definition of not being good was that I would bottom. When you're sitting in the kayak, you're sitting and your legs are forward and you're sort of wedged in using primarily your thighs. And then there's a neoprene skirt that basically keeps the water out. It doesn't hold you in the boat. If you are having a problem or if you can't roll up, there's a little loop and you pull this neoprene thing off and push yourself out of the boat. And when I initially looked at this drop, I thought, well, I could visualize the end result. And that would have been that I would have hit the bottom, not been able to roll because the turbulence was so great. Pull the spray skirt off, get out of the boat, and then it's like being in a washing machine for a little bit. You get a little banged up, but so that's what I envisioned. And what actually happened, though, is that the boat was pinned at the bottom, and it's a long story, and I won't get into this part of it, but actually there's another boater who had gone over this, been pinned, and I actually ended up beneath that boat as well. So I was pinned. The volume of the water and the force of the water was such that I was immediately submerged and basically plastered against the front deck of my boat. Not going to give up without a fight. So, of course, I did those things that you would normally do to get out of the boat. Tried getting the boat loose. I tried pulling the spray skirt off. Tried just pushing against the foot pegs that are in the boat. Just trying to force myself out. But the water and the force of the water was such that I couldn't even move my arm backwards enough to even get my hand to the spray skirt, let alone actually pull it off. It became clear fairly quickly that this was not going to be successful. And I also knew that where I was in the river was pretty inaccessible from shore. No one was going to particularly be coming after me. And so I thought, well, this is looking worse. And I did try again and again. And at a certain point, I gave my life over to God. I really and sincerely asked only that God's will be done. And I really meant it. At that moment, everything changed. At that moment, I was absolutely overcome with this physical sense of being held and comforted. And anyone in here who has a child, it's like if you take that newborn baby and you're absolutely giving it all the love and care that you can. And that's how I felt, and I felt great. I wasn't afraid. I was very comfortable. I actually was sort of thinking, wow, this is not bad, considering I had spent my life, even though I'm a water person, I do all sorts of boating and swimming and swam competitively, but the one thing that I never wanted to do was drown. All throughout my life, I was always afraid of that. And I sort of thought, gosh, this is what I didn't want to do and doesn't seem so bad. And then I had a bit of a life review. I went through the good things and perhaps the things that I would have changed. And I thought a great deal about my husband and my kids. I was continually reassured that they would be fine. That's not to say that I was told that they would be happy and cheerful and glad that I was gone, but I was reassured that they would be fine regardless of whether I lived or died. that seemed to go on and on and on. And I can't remember who it was that told me they weren't a patient person, but I was not a patient person either. And after a while, it was like, okay, we did the life review. I know everyone's gonna be fine. Let's get on with it. And I sort of kept doing these little self-assessment exams because I thought it was really quite an adventure that I was clearly drowning, because I knew that enough time had gone on that I had long passed being out of air. And there I was bored. And I thought, oh, this is really something. So then finally I felt my body being sucked out of the boat by the current. As I was being sucked out, the force is pushing me this way. So it was okay for my hips, but then when it came to my knees were bending back on themselves. And I mean, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I thought, well, it's probably my tibial plateau, and that feels like a ligament. And I thought, wow, I don't even think I'm feeling pain. And I wasn't. I still felt great. I had no pain and no fear. I was very calm. I was very peaceful. As my body came out of the boat, I could feel my spirit peeling away from my body, sort of like peeling apart two pieces of tape. Then finally, I felt my body released from the boat. And at that time, I felt my spirit completely released from my body. My body went downstream and my spirit rose up and out of the river. And I was immediately, yes, I wasn't breathing. I was aware of that. Sure.
I just asked if you were aware of breathing problems or having difficulty breathing while you were underwater or while all this was going on.
And my answer to that question was no. No, I wasn't panicking. Yes, I was entirely aware that I had no ability to breathe. I was aware of that when I was first submerged. I knew that I had to work very quickly. So no, I was actually aware and I could feel the water. I could really feel all the physical sensations. It was not uncomfortable, which is part of what was surprising to me, because I always thought that drowning would be horrible. So anyway, as soon as my spirit came out of the river, I was greeted by a group of people. I'm going to call them people, spirits. Everything sounds a little goofy. So whatever you want to call them, they were not what I would call angels. They were people, and they were people or beings that I knew I had known for an eternity, and I knew they had known me. I did not recognize them as my grandfather or my neighbor, people I knew that I had known on this earth, but I knew them, and I knew that this was true in a sense that is different from the way we talk about knowing things. It's a very pure knowledge at a very core base level. I knew that I had known these people. They were so joyful and they were brilliant. They had, many people have asked if they had bodies like legs and arms. And I'm not actually sure, because I mean, they had form. So it wasn't like this, some people said, well, was it just sort of this glowing ball of energy? No, they had form. They were actually formed people, but I think that they had on robes, but more than anything, they emitted such radiance that it was very difficult to sort of make out an outline. But more importantly, it's not what I was concerned about. Someone asked me once what I looked like. Like, did I look down and look at myself? And I never did. It was not important to me. Celebrating with these spirits was far more important than looking at what I was at that point. And it was only at that point, actually, that I sort of thought, well, okay, I guess I am dead. Because for me, and some people are different, but for me, it was this seamless transition. I'm sure I was dead in the boat in terms of no longer physically functioning, because that time period had probably been 10 minutes or so. I'm sure I was dead there, but it was only as I was celebrating with these spirits that I look back and I could see them drag my body over to the riverbank. It was only in looking at that scene and looking at my body thinking, well, okay, that was, thanks for being a good body for me. You know, I felt kind of really sort of a nostalgia and kind of fondness for it. Yes.
Do you suppose that you had circulation while you were not breathing? Like were getting blood to your brain in those 10 minutes?
For a couple minutes. For a few minutes, yeah. Not for 10. It doesn't work that way.
No, I mean without circulation to the brain for 10 minutes. Is that what you're possibly
right.
saying?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So
a
you're
long time.
Not brain dead.
Oh, let's see, where was I? I was kind of surprised and said, okay, I guess I am dead, and this isn't so bad. And time and space was different. Time and dimension. I'm sure as you've heard other speakers, you hear the same problem when it gets about to this point in their stories. Because we don't really have the language or even the ability to comprehend or describe some of the things adequately. It's sort of like if you live in a two-dimensional world, you can describe dots and lines and squares and circles, but not only can you not understand what a cube is, you don't even have the language. There aren't the words to describe a cube. And I would say that's the same thing with this. I don't even have the vocabulary really to describe what happened. All the words I'm going to use are very pale. The joy that we felt and the love that they felt for me was beyond anything that I could describe here. They were taking me along a path, and I knew that they were there not only to guide me along this path, but protect me. I don't know from what, but sort of the same I knew kind of a thing. I knew they were there to protect me. And we moved down this path toward this absolutely brilliantly beautiful domed hall. And this sounds like a goofy description, but it was sort of like the Superdome times 100. It was this domed hall that, again, was absolutely brilliant, exploding with color and beauty of an intensity that I couldn't possibly experience here on Earth. And I feel things deeply here, don't get me wrong. I really, really appreciate beauty and the beauty of nature, and I love my husband. I love my kids more than I can imagine loving anything else. But all of that pales in comparison to not only the beauty of this place, but the love was absolute and pure and complete. It was so alluring. I could hardly wait. This great hall I knew was a place that was sort of the entrance, and it was a place where we all are given an opportunity to choose God or turn away. I could hardly wait. I was ready. I thought, let me at it. And simultaneously, as we were going down the path, I could look back at the scene on the riverbank and see the guys doing CPR. And one of the people, and these three guys, the dad and the two sons, are very dear friends of ours. They teach water rescue. They have rescued many, many people over the years. And one of the hallmarks of emergency resuscitation is you just go through the protocol. You divorce yourself from the person, and you just keep going through the protocol until it either works or it doesn't. The one son at the time was very young. He was barely 18. And he just couldn't make that dissociation. He kept looking. I felt like he was looking right at me. I know he couldn't see me, but he kept saying, listen, Mary, I know you're here. Just come back and take a breath, please. And I would look back at him, and he looked so vulnerable. He just looked so young and sad and vulnerable that I would interrupt the spirits, and I'd say, I'll be right back. And then I'd go back to my body, and I would lie down, and I would take a breath. And then I would leave. You know, I've often joked to him since then that he was asking for the wrong thing. He was asking me to take a breath, and that's exactly what I did. And he did this a number of times. We went through the cycle multiple times. I would rejoin the spirits and we'd get a little further. And then I'd say, wait a second, and I'd go back. And I was really irritated. I really, again, if you have kids, you know that feeling when they're little kids, you're really tired, it's at the end of a long day, and you have to get up early, and they want a glass of water, and they want another story, and they want this and that, and you're finally just going like, get in bed. And that's how I felt. I felt like saying, just leave me alone, I'm going home. Because that is really how I felt. I felt like I was going home, to my real home. This is all great, but this is very temporary. And I felt like, finally, I was back. I got to the entrance of this hall, and I saw many, many spirits moving around. They were all very busy. I'm not sure what they were doing, but they were very busy. I knew they were being about God's business. When I arrived, everyone sort of took a moment and looked up, and again, this place exploded with joy. The remarkable thing to me is that I know that that happens with every person that shows up. It's like, oh my gosh, another spirit, hooray. And just as quickly, there was this sort of pall or this absolute sense of disappointment that then descended on them and on us. Then that's when the people or the spirits who had taken me down the path turned to me and told me that it wasn't my time, that I still had more work to do on earth, that I had to come back. So I didn't die without a fight. I didn't want to come back without a fight. So I objected. Yes. The question is, did I see children? No. It was just sort of ageless. Sort of between those ages of, I guess it changes as we change, but there's that age between sort of late 20s and early 40s when people can be anywhere in there and they all sort of look the same. And it was sort of like that. They weren't children, and I didn't see children. Not to say they aren't there. I only know what I know. I've been asked the same thing about pets. I only know what I know. Unlike some people, I did not sort of look around to take in everything. I will say later, this is jumping ahead, but when I was in the intensive care unit, I had another out-of-body experience and was in this beautiful field, and I did see children there. But in this experience, I did, and I really was very focused, yes.
As you were in the building, did those that were there take on more of a form like human, or were they robed? Were they different than those that you were with?
No, they were the same. And I never was inside. I came to this entrance, sort of this arched entrance. It sounds really goofy when I describe it, but it actually was really wonderful. I could see all the spirits inside that were very busy and running around, but they also looked like they had sort of robed. And so at that point in time, the spirits that had taken me there again said, well, tough luck, you're going back. They gave me some information about some of the reasons why I had to come back, and also told me that I would be given more information, which I was on this subsequent out-of-body experience. And at that time, they did tell me a couple of more minor things about my husband and a friend of ours, and they told me a bit about my son's death. They also told me that I had to come back and share my experiences. Reluctantly, I did go back to my body, and I very consciously remember sitting down, lying down, and then I was reunited with my body. For me, on the way out and the way back in, it was a very seamless transition for me. It was not violent or sudden. It was very seamless and peaceful and beautiful. Yes.
Did they call you by your name? Did they know your name?
No. Actually, I've never been asked that. But no, we never spoke like that. The way we spoke, they knew me, and I knew them. And we did not speak using our mouths and language, but we very much communicated.
And what did they say about your son's death?
Well, one of the reasons I had to come back was to be an absolute solid spiritual rock upon which my family and my community and a number of people throughout the country could stand and reach out to God after his death. He was a very unusual young man and quite remarkable and had a tremendous impact on people. And after his death, people were really devastated. One of my responsibilities was to help them take that event and see it as an opportunity to be inspired to truly make a difference in their own communities.
Mary, did his death occur before or after your experience?
10 years after.
Yeah. I'm not certain how to ask this, but would you say that you possess any abilities in this mortal realm, abilities to accomplish things that you feel like you couldn't do in the beyond, and vice versa? Is there an advantage to being in this body versus not? Just curious.
I'm not entirely sure what you're asking. I think we have this opportunity to come to Earth. We are here for different reasons. Some of us are here to learn things for ourselves. Some of us are here to help other people learn. But this is an incredible opportunity. We don't have much time. Our sense of time is altered. We think that 100 years is a long time, but we're on Earth for this very, very brief little period of time. We can't waste it. We need to get after it every day.
I just wanted to tell you, I'm of the LDS faith, and I truly am inspired by your remarks, because I truly know that you went through the experiences that you went through. The beings that you're talking about were the people that you had associated with, and I believe that you went to Spirit Paradise, and that there is work on the other side to be done. There's much work to do. And so I just wanted to tell you thank you for your experience, and thank you for your faith.
Thank you.
How did you accept or feel when you were told of your son's death?
Well, let me go backwards a little bit. I very much believe that very young children still remember where they came from. I believe that many young children are certainly part of this world, but the spirit world to them is not something that's crazy or unusual. When my son was 4 or 5, we were in a conversation, and I have no recollection of the conversation in terms of what brought this up, but I said, "Now, you know, Willie, when you're 18 something, blah, blah, blah." And he looked at me with absolute shock and said, "But I'm never going to be 18. You know that." And I looked at him, and he was so sincere, and that's not something I've 4 or 5 year old would say. And he wasn't saying it like, gee, 18 is so ancient. He was saying it like, what are you talking about? And when I asked him what he meant, he looked at me, he said, "Well, but that's the plan, you know that." So I sort of knew already. I will say that although I really did believe him, I'm not sure that I really believed it. So when I was told about his death and my responsibility, what was expected of me, it did not come as a surprise. Was I happy about it? No. The part of grief that is sadness, I don't think ever goes away. I mean, of course I want him here. I loved the guy, and I enjoyed spending time with him, but I was not surprised. Could it have been different? I sure wish it could have been, but it wasn't. So, let's see, now I'm back in my body. Now we're on this remote river in the middle of nowhere in 1999, and in 1999, Chile was not even developed really in Santiago. The guys who resuscitated me looked at me and said, "Well, okay, now what?" Yes.
You said that you felt that you were really home and very content with that. Did you ever politely argue with your guides and tell them that you didn't want to come back to Earth?
Oh, I did.
to stay here, that they should go take a swim or something?
I did. One of the reasons I didn't write about this or start talking about this earlier, I mean, this happened in 1999, and my son died in 2009. I didn't talk about this variant specifically because I did not want to come back. And I feel like that's an important part of this experience, because that alone, I feel, is great reassurance to people. I didn't want to come back. I was upset about it, and I didn't think it was fair to my children, who were still very young, to tell them that part of the story when they were young and have them wonder, well, gee, aren't I enough? I mean, as a physician, I've seen the fallout for families of suicide. And one of the fallouts is that the family members, especially children, feel like they weren't enough for the person to stay. And so I never wanted my kids to know that. But no, I did not want to come back. And although I wouldn't hasten it, I can hardly wait to go back. That's the reality. So they loaded me on top of a kayak so they could carry me. And looked up, and there were two Chilean young men there who weren't there earlier. No one said anything to them, and they didn't speak to anyone, but they started hacking a path through the bamboo, and you know, it was very difficult to get up the hillsides. Finally came to a little dirt trail and went along that for a couple hours, and finally popped out onto a dirt road. And I will tell you that as you talk to the guys, they said they didn't really know what they were going to do when they got to a road. They thought maybe they'd run down the road and try to find a tractor or something. But there's nothing there. So we popped out onto a dirt road, and there was an ambulance waiting. At that time, my husband showed up also. One of the people who had been on the river sort of freaked out when I was being resuscitated, and she took off running through the forest, and she came to where my husband was parked. So he arrived at the same time, and so we went in the ambulance and drove for a long time and finally came to a little clinic outpost, and my husband, who's an orthopedic surgeon, put some splints on my legs, and this is the only part of the story that is nuts. And I would not recommend what we did to anyone. I think that I knew I was going to go home for treatment. I wanted to be home. And I don't ever remember discussing it with anyone. I think my husband was in an absolute state of shock. And I think the other people involved looked at us as two physicians for guidance. And if we thought what we were about to do was okay, they weren't going to question it. But we actually drove to the little airport. It was closed. So we drove to another one, and that was closed. So we went to a hotel, and my husband carried me on his back, and we spent the night there. It gets worse. This, like I said, this is not what you should do. The next day, we took a little commercial flight, didn't call Medivac, commercial flight to Santiago, and got on the Santiago commercial flight, flew to Dallas, and in Dallas, we got on the commercial flight. And I know people in Dallas. I know plenty of physicians in different towns. But no, we got on the commercial flight. Pilots weren't that thrilled about it, and we'd taken one of the splints off to make it look not so bad.
What were the extent of your injury?
Well, I had multiple broken bones. Basically, my knees were broken on both sides, both legs, both sides, and all the ligaments were ripped out except for my ACL. On both sides. I had some pretty significant injuries. And I was developing an pneumonia, but then I also had this severe ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. The pilot was quite reasonable, suggesting that I wasn't an appropriate person to be on the plane. But his main concern was that I would slow people down in the event of a crash landing. So he said, don't worry about it. I just sprained my ankle. And we just lied. So that was fine. So we flew from Dallas to Salt Lake. Great hospitals in Salt Lake. But I didn't stop in Salt Lake. at this point, it had been a couple of, this was the end of the second day, and I was having a problem breathing. I knew I had a problem. But instead of staying in Salt Lake, instead of calling friends and medevacing out, we got into my husband's pickup truck and started driving home. Which, like I said, this is the only part, I can't explain it. I would never recommend it. But I think there was no one along the way who actually questioned us. And so we just kind of kept going. And then finally over Teton Pass, or actually over Pine Creek Pass, I couldn't breathe. And I thought I'd blown it. I thought I misunderstood. I thought I was supposed to go home, but I was wrong. So I just sort of kept apologizing. I was so sorry that after all this, I was going to die anyway. We did make it to Jackson, and then I was in the ICU. I don't have a watch. But there are all sorts of miracles that occurred during this time. I got to the emergency room, and my internist told my husband that there was no way I was going to make it through the night, because the ARDS, which is now a couple of days old, was pretty notable. I was terrible. So he brought the kids, and actually none of them wanted to come in, and the physicians didn't want the kids there. So I did survive the night. I survived, I think, in part because it just so happens, you know, I don't believe in coincidence, but the gal who works for my internist was in the emergency room. She was on her way to the high school basketball game where there were many, many people who know us and many people who didn't. But within a very short period of time, there were a lot of people praying. I'm not I never was a big one for praying for other people. But nonetheless, they were praying and I did survive the night. The next day, I will tell you, I still felt great. I had all these, you know, forget the ARDS. I had destroyed legs and I still had no pain. I felt great. I didn't have pain for about a week and a half. And I, during this time, really felt like I had one foot still in spiritual realm and one foot here on earth. I was still trying to argue my way back. And I do realize that we are here for a reason. And I'd been given some of the reasons. I was contemplating those reasons. And before I knew it, I was in this field, and I believe I was going to back in heaven. It was a field that was just, first of all, it was very large. It was that intensely beautiful coloring, like at the end of the day when you have that golden type of color. But again, it was so beautiful and so pervasive with love. It was incredible. I was sitting in the field, and this is where I did see children. I actually saw people of what seemed like different ages. I was talking to, it's hard for me to say this out loud. It just seems very, very presumptuous and arrogant, but I believe the person I was talking to was Jesus. We chatted, and I asked a lot of questions and was given a lot of answers. We did talk a little bit more about my son and the fact that I was expected to share my experiences. And before I knew it, I was back in my hospital bed in the ICU. I called the nurses and I wanted to know what medications I was given. Because I was thinking, you know, I like those. I'll have some more of those. At the time, I was told, other than antibiotics, I wasn't getting anything. Because as I said, I had no pain. I wasn't getting any kind of narcotic or anything like that. And I actually subsequently went back and looked through the medical records. And indeed, I really wasn't getting anything. During that time as well, I mean, there were some other things that happened in the ICU that were remarkable. I can't explain them in any way other than what they will appear to be. Things like the deacons from our church brought in all these magazines, and I'm an outdoors kind of gal, and they brought in Outside Magazine and Kayak Magazine and all these great magazines from their shop. They own the local ski shop. So I thought, great, okay, well, I feel good. Let me add them. And I took them, and they were not legible. I couldn't read anything. I mean, I've always had, except for now that I have to wear reading glasses, I've always had perfect vision, and I couldn't see anything. I couldn't have a conversation. I couldn't look at anyone. I couldn't watch TV. I couldn't look at anything because it was always blurry. I thought, oh, this is great. Then I asked for a Gideon's Bible because those are everywhere. I always wondered who reads those, and I discovered it was me. So the nurse brought in a Gideon's Bible, and I opened it to, I don't know, the Psalms or something, looking for sort of passages about give me strength and all that kind of thing, and everything was blurry. Kept looking, and then finally there was a passage that became clear, crystal clear. It said, rejoice always. I thought, well, okay. And then everything else was still blurry. Over the course of the next day or so, the next two verses became clear. It's rejoice always, pray without ceasing, and give thanks in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you in Christ. And I thought, wow. Well, I couldn't read anything else. I read those three verses for several days. I thought I was pretty good before this about, you know, being a happy person and all that sort of thing, but joy is a very different thing. What I've come to realize is that when you're a little kid, you have hope. You hope that God's promises are true. And then when you look around at other people's experiences, that hope transforms perhaps into a faith. And you have faith that maybe the promises are true. And there, for example, really is life after death. The key, though, is not getting stuck there. The key then is to look at your own life and see in your own life how God is working. And in doing that, that faith transforms into a trust. That trust is truly what allows all of us, and certainly allows me, to experience joy always. I can face any circumstance with a joyful and a grateful heart. That is because I have an absolute trust that there really is life after death. The promises really are true. So I can look at my son's death, for example, and yeah, I'm sad. But even in that circumstance, I can be joyful because I know that God has a plan for that and there is beauty within it. We may not always see the beauty. You know, usually it's always retrospective, but there is beauty. It's beauty on a much bigger scale than we can ever comprehend. And then pray without ceasing. Well, you know, that's pretty easy. I mean, if you've had a profound experience, you're profoundly changed. And I would say that my life is sort of a living prayer. It's on some level, I'm always in communication. And then give thanks. Living with a grateful heart is really a wonderful thing. So anyway, so I could read those three things and contemplated those for a number of days. And then slowly I could read other things. After about a week and a half, I did start to have pain. And then the spiritual world sort of receded and the physical world became more complete. And then I did have pain. And then I had multiple surgeries and I was in the hospital for about 5 weeks. And I was in a wheelchair for a number of months, had a number of surgeries. And I was really depressed for about a year and a half. I just couldn't believe that I was kicked out. I just couldn't believe that I was back on earth. And so it took me a long time. And so you asked earlier about my husband's experience. And my husband's experience was very different. In the immediate aftermath, I did tell a couple of people about my experience, but it was limited. It took me a long time to really process it. I am a cynic at heart. I am skeptical. I wouldn't believe someone else if they told me this story. It took me a long time to really think very concretely. I'm not a creative person. I'm a concrete thinker. And it took me a long time to really go through everything again and again and again and really think about it and say, okay, now, really? Really? Or could it be something else? And so it took me a long time to truly come to the conclusion that, no, this is not only a real experience, but it's more real than what we experience here. During that time, my husband's experience was putting one foot in front of the other. He had his own medical practice. He tried to take care of my patients. He had to take care of me. He had to take care of, I mean, I was like a pet rock. I couldn't put any weight on my legs, and I was in a wheelchair. And we were in this little house with narrow hallways, and so wherever the wheelchair was, that's where I was until someone came and moved me somewhere else. So he was taking care of me. He was taking care of four kids, all that were young, including a toddler. He put one foot in front of the other. He's often told people that while Mary was talking to God, I was changing diapers. And it's true. He was. But in addition to that, he also had this very guy kind of response, which was not only a feeling of incredible helplessness, but incredible guilt. Guys, bless you guys, you feel like it's your responsibility to protect your family. That's great. But he felt terrible guilt because he hadn't protected me. He wasn't even on the river with me. And so for him, it was a very different experience. I did tell him about it later, but I will tell you that in the writing of this book, for example, I knew that when I came back, I was mandated to share my experiences. It is way out of my comfort zone. I am, until now, I have always been a very private person. I don't talk about myself. I'm not a self-promoter. I am not a writer. I don't have time for it, let alone really the interest. Now, of course, my life is wide open for all to see, but I was also very busy. I, like most people, am really good at procrastinating. I just really didn't want to write it. I just kind of kept putting it off. One of the reasons, though, as I said, I didn't want to burden my kids with the feeling that I didn't want to come back. And then in 2009, I woke up with an absolute compulsion to put all of this in writing. I spent a few days and I did that. I was up at 4 a.m, put it all on paper, then revised it a couple of times and finished what I thought was the final manuscript a couple hours before my oldest son was killed. I look at that now, and for 10 years I felt really guilty that I didn't come back and tell everyone and write about it. I did mention it to a few people. I spoke at a couple of the churches and that sort of thing. But I really sort of kept it to myself. And I was always very protective how much time I allowed myself to really even think about it. I cannot express deeply enough how alluring what I'm going to call it heaven, call it what you want, the sense of absolute pure love and the beauty is greater than anything we experience here. And I found that in the years after my experience, if I talk to people about it, or if I really let myself think about it, I would feel myself sort of spending more time thinking about the spiritual world and less time thinking about the business at hand. We all need, I mean, every day really does matter. And every action, every choice really matters. And I found myself focusing less on the business at hand. I did put it off. Then I ultimately put it on paper just before he was killed. And that was actually a really great thing, because by writing it, I allowed myself to not only remember but fully immerse myself in the experience of God's world. Not that I could have forgotten, but I remembered very clearly what the expectations were of me for that period of time. So it actually turned out to be perfect timing that I procrastinated. There are a lot more little things, but I'll sort of let the conversation go where it will at this point.
Could you speak about how this has impacted you as a doctor? I know We have many questions that come up from people that really have a hard time wrapping their head around what death really means. There's the clinical side of death, and I'm not sure if I'm really clear, but maybe if you could just, from a physician, explain what your experience was from that perspective and how it has gone on to affect your practice from this point.
Well, I define death differently than I did before. As a physician, I always define death as the cessation of the physical being. But at this point, I would define it very differently. I think death really occurs when the spirit leaves. My father died shortly after I was out of the hospital. It was an interesting experience because, and it's a story I won't get into details, but he was on a ventilator and he was maintained on the ventilator just so that his kids could arrive. And it was very clear to me that he was gone. I looked at him and I said, he's dead. I mean, his spirit's gone.
Excuse me.
Yes.
You said that Jesus talked to you, and I just want to know, what did he say to you? I'm sorry, go ahead and finish. I'm just, my friend's in a hurry, so.
Before you have to leave, I'll tell you one thing, and then I'll come back to how it's changed me. I think one of the most profound things is really this question of good and bad. It's a question that is on many people's minds. We see things happen all the time that we say, oh, those are really terrible things. Whatever it is, 12 years, I've never ever had someone come up to me and say, oh, you are so lucky that you were in that kayak accident. But I have had many, many, many people come up and say, oh my gosh, I heard about that. That is so terrible. It's not. It was incredible. It was a great gift to me. And part of this conversation was really about this idea of good and bad. And I would contend at this point, there's no such thing. We call things good and bad, but we're all describing things from our own very small perspective. If you look at the quote, bad things that happen, I can almost guarantee you that those things resulted in incredible change in other people or in the culture. If you go back throughout history, I don't care what the event, look at Jesus as one example. There's a guy, regardless of what you think about him, there's a guy that was betrayed, arrested, humiliated, beaten, and killed. That's terrible. I mean, if that happened, if that was in the newspaper tomorrow, you would say, oh my gosh, that's terrible. But the reality is, we celebrate it. We think it was great. I could say that about almost every event. We don't really have the ability to see things real time as great. It seems like everything's always retrospective. We may not ever see it. You look back at your own life and you can pick out people who said something or did something to you that profoundly impacted your life. But those people had no idea. I mean, that's common among almost everyone. And so you have no idea what the ripple effects are of events. And so I would say that there really is no such thing as bad. It's all from the outside.
But that's a contrast versus good and evil.
I'm just talking about events, good and bad.
My question was choice. Did you have a choice to come back? Did you exercise a choice?
No, I didn't have a choice. If I had had a choice, I would have stayed. So going back to your question about how I've changed, I have changed very profoundly, subtly. I mean, it's not like I was a terrible person and now I'm a really good person. I was sort of the typical person. I was trying to live a good life and I didn't change. Outwardly, I would say that, my husband would say I no longer cared about anything. But I would actually say the opposite. I didn't care about the stuff of life. I didn't care about the little things, but I cared very, very deeply about what really matters. I think that the most profound change came, though, by absolutely knowing that there really is life after death. because it's one thing to kind of hope there is or sort of think maybe there is, but to truly know that there is life after death and that God is real, that God loves us beyond anything that we have the capacity to understand. It changes the way you see other people. It changes the way you see your time on earth. I tolerate anyone at this point. I may not like them. I'm not that great. But the thing that's interesting to me is I know that God loves every single human being on this earth as much as he loves me. So even those people that may irritate me or those people I think are jerks, they're beautiful in God's eyes. And so it has changed the way I see other people. The other thing is that not only in my life, but then this translates into my medical practice, is I absolutely know that we are each here with a plan. And that's not predestiny. That's not every minute of every day. There is free choice. But we are here for particular reasons. And going back to the people that may irritate me, that may be one of the reasons they're here. To teach me tolerance and patience. But knowing that we have a reason to be here really changes not only, as I said earlier, every day, every decision, every action, every interaction in terms of relationships really matter. I try not to miss an opportunity to help someone, uplift their spirit, help them in their journey. In terms of not only my life, but the medical practice then, I take care of the person's medical needs, but for me, it's complete integration because the spiritual side of their being is probably more important, but certainly equally important to the medical reasons for which they're seeing me. And so I'm able to minister to their spiritual needs as well as their medical needs. In addition to which, whatever their problem, I know that this is part of their journey. I see people who are in dire circumstances. Sometimes it's a life-changing injury. Sometimes it's disabling neck pain or back pain so that they can't do their job anymore that they've done for 50 years and they don't know how to do anything else. I see people at very low points or what they would consider to be very low points of their lives. Because I absolutely know that this life is temporary, I feel like I am able to see this, quote, tragedy as an opportunity. Because no one ever that I've ever met, no one ever changes when things are good. Now, we never change until we've been knocked on our knees. I don't know why, but that's just human nature. I feel like I'm able to take these people and help them see their circumstances as an opportunity for growth and change. I have many, many stories now of people who, the guy that pops into my mind, first off, is a guy in his 70s who dropped out of high school, had a laboring job for his whole life, had an injury, never could go back to work, didn't have any money. And he said, well, what am I supposed to do? And this guy, who is a guy's guy, I mean, I live in Wyoming, this is a guy's guy, he ended up becoming a watercolor painter. He actually turned out to be very good. He opened a gallery. He's very successful. He, to this day, on the anniversary, he keeps sending me thank you letters thanking me for changing his life. And I feel like that's been a profound change. I mean, I think I was certainly compassionate before, but that's different than really knowing that their circumstance really is a part of what they're going to become. It's not a profound outward change, but certainly that knowledge is a very profound internal change in way of viewing the world. Yes.
I appreciate you telling your experience tonight. And the question I have is, if I understand you right, you and your death experience, when you went to, I'm going to call it the spirit world, you communicated to you that your son was going to die. And then subsequent to that, you know, you came back. It's difficult for me to understand if you had that knowledge to live for 10 years until he died, and you use the word killed, wouldn't you want to stop that? I know that's a hard question.
Of course. I'm a mother. Of course I'd want to stop it.
That's my question.
Well, here's the thing. I have several responses. One is that I've never believed that my kids are mine. I believe that I have this incredible privilege to be their parent, but I don't believe they belong to me in that sense. It did change the way I parented. I cherished every minute with that guy. Did it change the way I let him live his life? No, because I knew that there were going to be some beautiful things that came of it. I knew that he would feel no pain. He would be just as joyously greeted, and he wouldn't want to come back. It did not change the way he led his life. Would I want to stop it? Well, selfishly, of course. Having said that,
how do you live with yourself emotionally? I don't know how I could.
That's because you're a guy. No, and no, I'm not saying that in a negative. I'm really not. Men and women definitely feel guilt differently. A very typical response to a child's death by a guy is guilt. I'm not going to tell God what to do. It really is sort of like going back. When I was going down this path and I didn't want to come back, someone at that point had asked me, well, during that time, didn't you think about your children? And the answer is, I really didn't. I had been reassured that they would be fine. I would say the same thing. I had been told they would be fine by God. And who am I to say differently? And with regard to my son, I am not the one who chose the outline or the journey, the plan for his life. He was here for his purposes. I don't necessarily know all of them. I have an absolute, unwavering trust that God does have a bigger picture that is more beautiful than anything I can imagine. And so it really is only with that trust that I could walk forward knowing that that was in my future. You know, my husband is a guy. But just so you know, I mean, I say this sort of kidding, but my husband felt horribly guilty. And even I had told him sort of what I had been told, and he sort of knew it. I'm sure he didn't believe it. But he felt so much remorse about his inability to protect our son that he went all the way back. He said, well, if we never moved to Wyoming, he wouldn't have started skiing. And if he didn't start skiing, he wouldn't have been invited to the ski team camps. And if he hadn't been invited to those camps, then he wouldn't be in northern Maine. And if he wasn't in northern Maine, then he wouldn't be on the road roller skiing, and then he wouldn't have been hit by the car. You can question all sorts of things. That what if game can go on forever. But you can ask the questions of what if going both ways. Well, I don't know. I mean, I could go on for an hour about that. But I think the answer to your question is that it took me a year and a half after my experience to, number one, decide that it was real. Number two, decide that, yep, it was so real that I do trust. And I'm here, and I'm going to step forward into my future, which was partly unknown, partly known, with that trust.
I have the same question, interestingly, but from a female perspective. And I'm curious, because you mentioned the importance of relationships. I want to know, as a mother, knowing that your son was going to die before he was 18, how did that change how you treated each day and how you saw him and how that changed your experience with all of your children?
I truly, truly cherished every day with him. And my other kids, although it wasn't true. My other kids would claim that he was my favorite. I will say I cherish my time with all my kids, but with him, it probably was just that little extra. I never missed an opportunity to express my feelings. I never, both with him and because of him, with other people in my life, I never leave things unsaid. And I never left anything unsaid with him. When he died, I will say that the sadness is a different part of grief, and I miss his physical presence, but I have no regrets. I loved him dearly. He knew he was loved. He had this incredible life. He experienced his life and achieved incredible things. He achieved more in his life than most of us ever hoped to achieve. It did change how I viewed every day.
Did it make you a better mother? Did it change you as a mother? Did the experience make you a better mother?
My kids might disagree.
I mean, do you feel like it did?
But I think it did, because truly, I became very patient. And I don't think that was one of my strengths prior to that. As a mother, and especially, I mean, four kids and then husband, the whole thing. I mean, women are, they have to do everything. I think it's very easy to forget that every day is important. Forget that when you're making lunches and you're sick of doing it, I think it's very easy to forget that every day really is important. Every day you are modeling, not only for your kids, but for other people, you're modeling love. You're reflecting God's love. And so I think it did make me a better mother.
I actually don't have a question, but I have a cute little story that goes just right along with this. I just recently took an oceanside vacation to Oregon, and it's absolutely gorgeous. But my sister and I were walking through one of these little shabby chic shops, and of all things, I don't know what made me stop and read this shabby little antique pillow that had the neatest saying embroidered on it that went absolutely with this entire experience we're having with you tonight. As the caterpillar crawled into his cocoon and saw the end of the world, the master saw a butterfly, of all things. And so that went right along with everything that you just said. You didn't want to come back because you didn't want to be in a cocoon again.
True.
But however, the watercolor guy ended up becoming a butterfly. So maybe that's what you could tell your patients now is, you know, maybe you're going to become a butterfly.
I don't know if most of these cowboys want to be a butterfly, but it is a good story. Yeah.
Given the fact that I believe we have a lot of free will to do what we want, before this experience started, your husband had a bad back. He's never had a problem. Did your gut at that point say anything? But then you did mention before you got in the water that there was something telling you something wasn't right. Do you think that God sent that for you to give you the opportunity to go forward with an experience, even though you didn't know what it was, sent you a message saying, you can choose not to do this?
I do think that we have this outline when there are branch points, and I do believe in free will. I think perhaps, I mean, at that time, I don't think I was... In tune isn't quite the right word, but I don't think I was sensitive to responding to triggers like that. I think if I had that same experience today, I probably wouldn't go on the river. Not because I know something bad's going to happen, but I've become very tuned in to how I feel, and even with other people.
Okay, thank you.
Did you see any beautiful scenery, like mountains or buildings or...
Well,
of that nature.
It's difficult to describe, but beauty for me does include mountains and color. It was almost as though everything that I perceive as beauty, I experienced simultaneously. It was as though I could truly not only just see it, but I could hear it and feel it and taste it. It was all-encompassing. And so it was, the answer is yes to all those things. But it was all simultaneous.
This thing where you want to go back, and I can understand that. Do you feel like you have one foot in this world and one in the other?
No.
You actually feel like you're in this world and you want to go there?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But that's very conscious. I am here, and I am fully here.
But you still want to go there?
I can hardly wait.
I understand that.
The question is about the trust that you feel now. Not everybody has the kind of experience that you had to get you to that point. I work as a hospice chaplain, and I work with mostly elderly people who are very close, very near death. They may have had a religious belief all their life, and they may have practiced their faith all their life. But when it comes down to the last few days, and you try to assure them that there is something good on the other side, they said, "I hope so."
Right.
They waver. How can I? And it's not enough to tell them, no, take my word for it. It's going to happen. It's good because Dr. So-and-so told me, and take my word for it.
Well, it's tough if you only have a few days. I think the problem is that people are very complacent, and you reach the point of faith and you stop. You stop looking. That's the real problem. I think, and this is sort of cold to say, but I think it's really an intellectual laziness. Now, we have our faith and we feel like life is good and okay, you plug along.
Yeah,
but faith is really looking at other people. The laziness part is this. I think that every person can find God working in their own lives if they put out the effort to really look. And it's looking with an open heart and open eyes. It's writing things down. If you write things down, all the weird things that happen, all the coincidences, all the things that happen, and you write those down over a period of time, I believe every single person can ultimately look back on the patterns and go, wow, that's statistically not possible. But you have to do that. And most people, I think, get stuck in faith rather than transforming it to trust because they really feel quite comfortable and they don't put out the effort to look. If you actually look around, maybe not every minute and not every day, but if you look around, you will see things in your own life that happen that can't be explained by chance.
But it takes a certain kind of discipline.
Well, that's what I mean. I think it's an intellectual laziness.
Yeah.
I think everyone can do it. The people that don't are going to remain in a state of faith, which is not terrible. But you're right. When push comes to shove, it's the doubt that creeps up.
I believe in that ultimate trust, and I pray with my patient frequently, and that's what we pray for God to give him trust, that he will love them, that he will be there to comfort them, that all will be well.
Your faith and your belief is something that will transcend their doubt, truly. That you can be that instrument that maybe fill in that doubt for them. And that's kind of the beauty of the near-death experience.
My question is, was there a sense of any type of judgment when you were conversing with Jesus, or when you went through that experience, did you feel any remorse of things that you might have done when you were during some time in your life when you were young or anything like that, or was it just all a sense of joy and peace?
When I was still in the boat, we did have a little life review. I won't say there were things that I just thought, oh my gosh, that's really bad. But there were things, and it wasn't judgment. The judgment came from me. And the remorse came from me, not externally. There were things that I felt remorse. Like, gee, I could have done something differently, better, more loving.
Would you say then that the forgiveness that came from God was immediate?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
God's ability to forgive is way beyond what we're capable of. This book that I wrote, kicking and struggling, called To Heaven and Back, goes through everything we've talked about and more. I'll tell you one of the really fantastic things. First of all, you can get it from Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Even this, the writing of this book is fantastic if you want to talk about God's guidance. I absolutely believe that if you are going and doing the things you're supposed to be doing, everything falls together. Everything seems really easy. If everything always seems like a struggle and it's not working out, you're probably going in the wrong direction. And with this book, I don't know anything about writing. I'm a spine surgeon. And I won't say I haven't put out effort, because I have. I mean, I sort of wrote it and waited around because I really wanted a publisher to come in and publish it, because then I wouldn't have to do anything. And then one day I was listening to the radio. Any of you are familiar with Christian singer Josh Wilson? And he has a song, the refrain of which is, I refuse to wait for someone else to do what God has called me to do myself. And I heard that and I just thought, oh, I don't really like that. But I really, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I said, well, okay, then. I guess I just have to do it myself. All of a sudden, everything just started falling together. The right person showed up at the right time to do whatever it was in that part of the process that needed to be done. That's been true from start to finish. Everything has just sort of happened. It's incredible. So I think it's an incredible privilege to share my experiences. It's an incredible privilege to speak to you guys. And I only hope that by hearing my experiences and sharing my story, that it really will inspire you to look at your own lives and say, wow, yeah, that's happening in my life. But anyway.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and wrap up the formal end.
So thank you.
I want to thank you, Mary, so very much for being our guest.